don't know about you, but life rarely seems to turn out quite as it appears in the brochures, does it? You know, the estate agent's blurb shows you a dream house. The employer's advert describes your dream job. And, of course, the tour operator's brochure pictures the dream holiday. And you buy the house and you take the job and you book the holiday. And even if it's not with BA, reality rarely turns out quite as it was described. The brochure, or the covenant promise, as the Bible puts it, had been given way back to an aging man with an aging wife. A childless couple who were given this dream ticket that he will be the father of a great nation with a global, worldwide significance. And the God will be their God. More than that, the place they're going to be given to live in will be just like a promised land. Now, not sandy beaches and palm trees and blazing suns, but flowing with milk and honey. I say all of this because Exodus 1 is not really the beginning of the story. In my translation, and I'm one of those sort of dinosaur types that have still got the NIV, it doesn't have the word, but even the young trendies with the ESV won't have the word either, because I've looked it up. Actually, it begins with the little word and. And these are the names of the sons of Israel. It's just a little word that links it back to the book that came before, to Genesis. It's like watching Lord of the Rings. You didn't have to be there for long, did you, to discover that the Two Towers was not the start of the story. You see, they'd had the great promises. They got a glimpse of the brochures. There'd been a hiccup or two along the way. But Jacob had made it into the promised land, only famine had driven them out into Egypt. And of course they discovered by the time they got there that the young son Joseph was there ahead of them. Indeed, he was running the country, he was the prime minister, he was in prime position to look after them. And that's where we join the story. And these are the names of the sons of Israel, who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family. See, the wonderful happy ending is in sight already. God's got everything sorted, we only need to head onwards and upwards. Well, if only the Christian life were like that. Too often it can seem rather like reality after the brochures, can't it? And if it can seem like that to us now, it must have seemed like that to them then. Watch how the story unfolds. See, if you read these opening couple of chapters of the book of Exodus, it really does look as if it's about the God who'd lost the plot. As you read the first chapter, it is actually not so much an old story as a pretty familiar one. See, you come to verse 6. Joseph and all the brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Remember, Genesis 1 starts with creation and multiplying, and here we've got the book about rescue, and it begins with people multiplying. Literally, they swarmed. They bred like rabbits. The leap from childless Abraham to a great nation suddenly seems doable. So the land was filled with them. Only understand the reality. They are immigrants. And there are lots of them. And you can't go shopping without bumping into one or another of them. And what do too many immigrants lead to? Fear. Fear. This is a modern day story. Get to verse 8. There's a new king who didn't know about Joseph. He comes to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they'll become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. You get too many immigrants and we're afraid they'll take our jobs. They'll take our homes. They'll take over our country. Actually, maybe worse still, they might leave. Which sounds good, except for the fact that we are economically dependent on them. Who's going to run everything if they go? So, verse 11. They put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labour. And they built Python and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. Yeah, keep them in the jobs that none of the locals wanted. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labour in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all the hard labour, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. Now, never mind the holiday hotel that looked wonderful on the brochure and turns out to be next to a building site. I'm here, they're doing the building. Keep the numbers down. Well, that's how we react now, isn't it? The latest immigrant outrage. I saw the newspaper headlines, you know, asylum army. Asylum, the joke's on us. Because the latest statistics showed that asylum seekers were increasing in the UK and decreasing everywhere else in Europe. So the government are promising to halve the number of asylum seekers accepted. The king of Egypt had much the same thought. He was just rather more draconian than any government can afford to be. He said to the Hebrew midwives, verse 15, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it's a boy, kill him. And when that failed, he skipped the subtleties and went straight for ethnic cleansing in verse 22. Yeah, that's where we're beginning. You read on to chapter 2, some slightly more familiar stories. There's just a flicker of hope, isn't it? You remember the boy in the basket in the bulrushes, and he escapes the massacre, and then he sees the Egyptian oppressing his people and flattens him and kills him, strikes a blow for freedom. But by the end of the chapter, he lands up in exile. The state usually manages to crush the rebel. Now, don't be fooled either, please, by the pace of this story. This wasn't a blip. You know, if you've been living through it all, a time dragged as you go through these two chapters. See verse 6 of chapter 1? Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. See verse 8, a new king who didn't know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. Or you come to chapter 2 and verse 11 and you read, one day after Moses had grown up. They grew up slower in those days. We're told later on that's when he's 40. Some of you haven't grown up yet, have you? You get to verse 23 of chapter 2. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. Regime change. Yeah, but nothing changed. The Israelites went on groaning in their slavery. Hard not to think, if you've been living through year after year after year of that, that God had lost the plot. All that time and he's done nothing. Actually, he hardly gets a mention. And when he does at the end of chapter 1, in response to the bravery of the midwives, it really is not like the tour company owner coming to sort things out. It's much more like the holiday rep who sees the problem and is grateful for those who help and encourages them, but frankly it changes little or nothing. See verse 20, God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. How wonderful, you think, and then you read verse 22, then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people, every boy that's born you must throw into the Nile. The God who's lost the plot. let me be personal for a moment. See, let me put the question this way. How do you handle the absence of God? How do you handle the absence of God? Now, please don't give me the pious answer that he's never away and he's always with us. I mean, I do know that. That's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about those times when it really does not feel as if he's around at all. When all the evidence and all our senses point to the fact that God's lost the plot, or at the very least, he's lost our file. You know it? How do you handle those times? Because see, Exodus, it wasn't written for the Exodus generation, if you think about it. It was written for those who came after. It was written because this is a common experience of God's people right through history. This wasn't the last generation whose shoulders would slump and they'd think, how could God allow this? Why has God allowed this? Why doesn't God do something about this? Why has God forgotten us? How do you handle the absence of God? Do you ever get as far as the very end of chapter 2? Verse 24. As the people are crying out to God because of their slavery, you suddenly read this striking verse in verse 24. God heard their groaning. And he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them, knew them, the ESV puts it. God heard, God remembered, God saw, God was concerned. Two verses at the end of the two chapters. Suddenly, God's hugely active. And please do not carry around a picture of someone with dementia for whom the clouds lift and for a moment everything was clear and they remembered. It's not that. That's not what the writer's trying to tell us. He's wanting to tell us that God acted. You see, we've got the ability to see something and do nothing about it, haven't we? But when this God sees, he acts. He's concerned. And did you notice what God remembered? His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. His promises. Because see, this God we're going to follow through much of the book of Exodus, he is the God of the promise. And right at the beginning, the writer wants to tell us this. He is the God who is going to carry out the promises that were there in the brochure in the previous book. This is not a story of how God rescues exploited and enslaved and racially discriminated against people. The Bible tells me of God's concerns for them. But don't use Exodus to just justify all of that. It's not actually in itself the proof text for fighting oppression in South America or apartheid in South Africa. It's about a God who keeps his promises to his people. The plot's the promise, and he has not lost it. Yeah, they will be a great people. And the God will be their God. And they will have a promised land. Now, I guess I imagine pretty much all of us here this evening. I have known the kind of freedoms and privileges that the vast proportion of our world has never known and rarely seen. I've never known economic deprivation. Not in any significant way. And yet in the most meaningful way of all, I've stood where these people stood. I have known oppression and slavery. I've known what it is to be trapped by sin. unable to break free of it, all too aware of the death sentence cutting me off from the living God, but unable to save myself. My cries and groaning won't rescue me. I need God to act. And just as you and I may well know personally that depressing sense of God seeming to have lost the plot, the individual sufferings of a Job or the psalmist get echoed in our experience, so does the church as a whole. I mean, persecution is a regular feature of Christian life. I read a persecution quiz in a Christian newspaper the other month. Here was question one. Try yourself on it. It's multiple choice. You've always got a chance, haven't you? You can put the pin in the right place. How many persecuted Christians are there in the world? You've got four options. It's like millionaire, only no coughing, please. Naught. Naught. 10 million. 200 million. Or 1 billion. Yeah, you needn't put your hands up. But the answer was, well, the answer was that 200 million Christians face persecution in the world today, and another 200 to 400 million worldwide face some form of discrimination simply for being Christian. Keep your finger in Exodus, will you? Just come on towards the end of the story. Come to the last book in the Bible in Revelation 6. I just want you to see that handling this idea of a God who seems to have lost the plot is something that's going to be part of Christian life all the way through history. Turn to Revelation 6 and verse 9. Here's one of John's great visions. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who'd been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they'd maintained. And they called out in a loud voice, "How long, Sovereign Lord? How long before justice is sorted out? Have you lost the plot?" "No," says God. Verse 11, "Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer." Not even in the book of Revelation have you got magic wand Christianity. Wait a little longer. But by the time you get to virtually the very last page of the Bible, to Revelation 21, suddenly you do see, don't you, the promised land. And the brochure hardly pictured it right for us. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth," verse 1. Verse 3, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. And he'll wipe every tear from their eyes. And there'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.'" Now, the brochure hasn't got it wrong. When you come back to Exodus and the end of chapter 2 and discover that for all that he seems to have lost the plot, here's God hearing and remembering and seeing and concerned. And someone asks you, how do you handle the absence of God? Have you got to the stage where even when God feels absent, you can still trust the God of the promise? That he is Lord of history no less in the bad times than in the good times. This God who looks as if he's lost the plot has actually remembered his promise. See, the message of these chapters is not that God's lost the plot. It's really quite the reverse. When I did what Mr. Jackman tells me to do with our Cornhill students up north and made them do some work and do all the hard work for me for preparing this, I asked them what was the message of these two chapters. And one of them came up with this. He said, "Oh, well, the message is, don't forget God remembers." That's it, isn't it? How do you handle the absence of God? Don't forget, God remembers. This is the God who keeps his promise. The God who'd lost the plot, no. People who ignored the plot. See, when you've got the benefit of hindsight, and Exodus was written to give you and I the benefit of hindsight, if you think about it, it's possible to see that God's been at work even when it looked as if he's off the case. God remembered his covenant. Yeah, but you don't see God suddenly leafing through his filing cabinet, picking out the right document, scratching his head as he tries to work out how on earth is he going to deliver his people. He'd already got the rescuer in place. Not just in place, but actually trained up by the enemy. And so is everyone else in on the plot? No, of course not. God often operates in spite of, rather than because of us. See, if how do you handle the absence of God is a question we need to face if we live the Christian life, how do you handle the presence of God is one as well. How do you respond when God is at work? And don't be too quick to give me the answer. See, look at some of the characters here. Look at Pharaoh. He didn't handle it at all well. Come back to chapter 1 and verse 8. This new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt and starts sorting out the slaves. I mean, it's almost staggering, isn't it? Joseph, the man who'd actually rescued the country and made its fortune for it, and now a ruler comes to power and he didn't know about it. Whether it's willful or stupid ignorance, who knows? He doesn't know his own country's history, never mind God's promises. And as the Israelites multiply and grow, just as God promised, it's in spite of Pharaoh's edicts and massacres. As Moses is rescued from the bulrushes, it's against Pharaoh's orders. In fact, the child doomed to death by Pharaoh's decree will in fact be the means through whom the whole of Israel will escape the decree and the country. So the Hebrews are in on the plot, are they? Oh no, they're actually just the same. When Moses starts defending one of them and kills the Egypt, it's not seen as the mark of a rescuer, but as a threat. Look across to chapter 2 and verse 11. One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. And glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And the next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" And the man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us?" It's the problem when God steps in, isn't it? We actually can't carry on running our world the way we want. Now, how do you handle the presence of God? For Egyptian and Israelite, you see, the thought of another intrusive ruler threatened their world. It's the problem for Christians today as well. We all long to offer Jesus the rescuer to people, but you'll discover Christian churches will fight among themselves at the thought of Jesus the ruler telling us how to run our lives. Who made you ruler and judge over us? This is the opening chapters. They're just part of a deeply ingrained pattern. Again, keep your finger in Exodus. Come on another journey with me back to the New Testament, to Acts chapter 7, to Stephen. The first Christian martyr, is he, with his great speech. The idea that this pattern of rebellion against God is an ingrained one is exactly the point of everything Stephen's saying. So come to chapter 7 and verse 35. He's talking about Moses, and he says this is the same Moses whom they had rejected with the words, "Who made you ruler and judge?" God's rescuer, rejected by God's people. It's no different when the rescuer came. See how Stephen's speech ends in verse 51? "You stiff-necked people, with uncircumcised hearts and ears, you're just like your fathers, you always resist the Holy Spirit. Was there ever a prophet your fathers did not persecute? They even killed those who predicted the coming of the Righteous One, and now you have betrayed and murdered him." For Jesus, of course, it was Herod, not Pharaoh, ordering the massacre. But Jesus too grew up to discover that the people he came to rescue were wary and rebellious at the thought of him ruling over them. They rejected him and crucified him, betrayed him and murdered him. They couldn't handle the presence of God. What makes us think we're any different? I suspect that if we'll really face up to God's rule this summer, the idea of "who made you ruler and judge" will easily cross our mind at some point in the coming weeks and months. The easy lie will be on our lips, and that voice from inside will suggest we should be telling the truth. Who made you ruler and judge? When the lustful look is crossing our mind, and put the look the other way comes in, the greedy act is replaced with the idea that I ought to be generous. The cowardly silence, broken by a voice suggesting I should speak up. In the heat of the silly squabble, I'm told to swallow my pride. Who made you ruler and judge? I was at a student mission earlier this year, and on the last night I was talking with a number of these endless Chinese who were coming, and had made some response. A couple of them seemed to have been genuinely converted, I heard later on. And this guy had patiently waited while they chatted away to me for about 5 or 10 minutes. And for someone to wait that long, I thought he really wants to talk, because he was in front of all the crowd. And he talked to me. He was a rower. And he'd come along because the coach of his crew was a Christian and had won his respect. And he wasn't really interested, but I came for Bill's sake, he said. And he said, "God spoke to me tonight." That's really rather exciting, because I thought it really meant I'd spoken to him. He came on and he made more and more encouraging noises. You know, I really hadn't thought there was anything in this Christianity, but there obviously is. And I was thinking, this guy, he's nearly there. It's wonderful. And then we got to the end, and he just said this to me. He told me about his girlfriend. And he said, "I've been sleeping with her for a couple of years now, ever since our first night together. I'm not going to give that up." I suddenly realized how wonderfully attractive Jesus the Rescuer was. But who made you ruler and judge over me? Even as God spoke to him, he was drawing his own lines. Don't forget, God remembers. He'll carry out his promise with us or in spite of us. The God who'd lost the plot. No, this is the God who keeps his promise. The people who ignored the plot. Oh, yes, but this is the God who keeps his promise. one final twist as we finish. See, at first sight, it seems a rather sordid story as Moses grows up, doesn't it? This brutal murder of the Egyptian and the guilty check that no one's looking before he thumps him. But even if it's true, it's possible there was another motive running through Moses' mind. So as you finish, just turn with me, will you, to the book of Hebrews. We'll leave Exodus, well, we won't really, we'll just look at it from another angle and come to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 and verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he'd grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasure of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. Moses, you see, had actually had a privileged education, the background, the best education money could buy, Eton and Oxbridge, a good job, a cushy position, guaranteed income for life. And at one level, here's the one man who trusted the plot. See, to live by sight, which is the opposite of faith, actually condemns me to live for now. If I'm living by sight, now is all I've got. To live by faith, to trust in a God who's not lost the plot but will keep his promise, why, that means I'm free to live for then. Not a dusty past it had its day then. A future glorious, worth living for, worth suffering for then. And we live in a time when we don't have to look for the rescuer in our midst. He's already come. Though Jesus will come again. But don't be disappointed if you discover he's not a popular cause. Don't be disappointed if standing with him puts you in a despised minority, because that's actually what the brochure warns us about. Just make sure you're one of his. Some people keep thinking that the issue is all about some decision for Jesus in a church meeting. I think Moses is a reminder that it's not really. People ask me when my Christian life began. I talk about a night I knelt by my bedside in my student bedsit and prayed for the first time for years. But in many ways, just as significant a moment came about 10 days later. It was a college student union meeting. And the Christian union were upset about some motion that was being put, and they were all voting one way. I can't even remember what the issue was. I don't really know the rights and wrongs. But everyone knew I'd been getting friendly with one or two of these Christian types, and, you know, was Palmer joining the God Squad or not was the sort of thing. And I kind of came to the meeting and I slipped in on the back row, which I thought was a wise place to sit. If you're going to, you know, none of those secret ballot, it was hands up stuff. I thought it was fairly safe. Of course, the big mistake I made, because I slipped in at the last minute on the back row, was to forget it was a student meeting. And of course, most people came about a quarter of an hour later. And all my mates sat on the cupboards just behind the back row. And when it came to the vote, and I voted with the Christian Union, I knew exactly what they were saying behind me. I lost my credibility with the rugby club and with the college social scene. And I guess that was as crucial a moment for my Christian life as my prayer by my bed, in my bedsit. See, the months ahead, will we stand with a Christian? No, not the cool, attractive Christian, the one who's a wimp in the group. The one who's the butt of the office joke. Will I tell the truth when it gets me unfairly treated? Will I refuse to be involved in the dubious deal when there's nothing in it for me now? Don't forget. God remembers. The man who trusted the plot. This is a book about a God who keeps his promise. But yes, it is also the story of Moses, the type of the rescuer, certainly, but actually also the story of any man or woman who believes in and lives as if God keeps his promise.